Hey, how's it going, everybody? I am Philip Drew, Administrator, and this is the Weekend Interview Show. Our first guest today is Jesse Walker. He's the Associate Editor of Reason Magazine and the author of Rebels on the Air, an alternative history of radio in America. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Let's see, you know, there's a lot of big news over the summer about the FCC's new rules about media consolidation. And the last I heard, I think actually I read a Bill Sapphire column in the New York Times that was about the Senate moving to, at least a committee in the Senate, moving to overrule that. And I was wondering if you can tell us what's the status of the new FCC so-called deregulation.
Well, the status is it's still in place, although, I mean, what the Senate's going to do is still up in the air. The most promising thing to me about what's going on in the Senate, and I'm generally as cynical and dubious about what the Senate's doing as I am about what the FCC did that they're trying to undo, because it's really, I mean, people use the word deregulation, and you might expect some sort of that to mean something really radical, like we will know, in this case, it's about ownership restrictions. So you might expect the new rules to say something like, we will no longer regulate how many media outlets you can own, and instead you get things like, in markets with five or more TV stations, the company may own up to two stations, but only one of those stations can be among the top four in the ratings. So it's what we're really looking at here is different people, different interest groups, with different interests as far as how precisely the media market's going to be regulated, trying to get the rules established the way they like it. But getting back to the beginning of what I was saying, the most promising thing is that this whole to-do happened around the same time that the MITRE study, which is the study that of the effects of low-power FM broadcasting. This is something that when the Congress almost completely eviscerated the FCC's plan for a very limited legal low-power FM system. One of the requirements was that the FCC do a study to see how much interference low-power FM would actually cause, or specifically changing the requirements for how far stations have to be separated from one another on the dial. Well, it was released. Some of the activists had to kind of prod them to release it. It took them a few months after the study was completed before they made it public. And it showed basically that there is, for all intents and purposes, no risk of significant interference by allowing more stations onto the air. And so there is some talk of including, along with whatever bill, you know, the Senate passes, some sort of restoration of the original plan to allow more low-power stations on the air, although still not nearly as much as you would see in a truly open spectrum. So I don't know if I've jumped into too much of a specific answer for you there, but that's like the one real you know, ray of hope of any kind sort of mixed in this. As far as, again, the status of the rules, what the FCC passed in June is still, it's still set to become, law once it's been approved by the courts.
Is there any move in the House of Representatives to do the same thing as the Senate?
Yes, absolutely. And as for, you know, when any of this is going to come to a vote, I couldn't tell you.
And, you know, one thing I have to say about that Sapphire column that I read was he was really putting the pressure on George Jr., that, hey, man, you don't want to be on the wrong side of this issue, buddy, because you're going to lose anyway. You might as well join the right side and roll this stuff back. But, you know, part of what you're saying about, you know, how specific the regulations are, and, well, they just changed it from this to that, but it's just barely a change. Like, if they roll it back to the way it was last May, that still isn't going to be that much better than the new stuff, right?
No, I mean, I remember when the debate was going on. The FCC made its decision in early June, and in April and May especially, there was a lot of discussion of this, in the media, in newspapers, online, and so on. I'm much more than you usually see for an arcane, what would ordinarily be treated as an arcane regulatory decision. And this was because people are really concerned about media concentration, and they jumped on this as sort of a symbolic issue. And there was I had to, I was in these, people would call me up for comments, and I went on a couple of radio shows at the time, and I didn't really fit into either box because I thought on the one hand that some of the stuff that was, a lot of the stuff that was being said about the FCC's proposal or what they were, what was at the time believed to be their proposal because they hadn't even made public what they were considering yet, was alarmist, was coming from people who really wanted to have, you know, the media regulated more strictly so as to ensure that their points of view are more dominant. And at the same time, I didn't really have any interest in defending what the FCC was doing because this was the same sort of behind closed doors, manipulative re-regulation that the FCC, does as a matter of course. There was a report in the New York Times, and I actually tried to get this. Yeah, here we go. This was when the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, had their convention in April. The New York Times had this report that the FCC chairman, Michael Powell, met with several broadcast executives in a hotel room in Las Vegas to talk about sort of the trade-offs. I mean, the executives, I'll read from the story. The executives from Post Newsweek stations, Scripps Howard Broadcasting, Hearst Argyle Television, Cox Television, and Billo had tried unsuccessfully for more than a year to meet with him to discuss a petition they had filed against the networks. According to the participants in that meeting, Mr. Powell listened to the group's opposition to changing the national ownership cap and then posed what he called a hypothetical question. Would the group support an increase in the number of TV stations one company can own if the FCC ruled favorably on some aspects of their petition? Well, this was happening on the background of the FCC having had just one public forum on the rule change. And so there's this real anger that these decisions are being made behind closed doors by a group of five commissioners rather than in this, more public manner. Now, from a libertarian point of view, you want to go further and say you don't want to have, a much bigger group voting on how the media is being is going to be governed. You want to loosen up the rules across the board, not just loosen up the rules that help the people who have, big ownership now, but loosen up the rules to allow more stations to come onto the air, to make it cheaper for stations to get on the air, to widen the range of what people can say, to not have these increases, these alterations in the copyright rules. This is moving away from the FCC, but it's very important when you come to online media that have been crushing a lot of online stations having an effect on what people can or cannot sample in the course of putting together some larger creative package. And that sort of stuff just wasn't on the table. I was initially, at the same time that I was cynical about what the FCC was doing, I was feeling like, the opposition is coming from people who just want to move to a different set of regulations. They still want the FCC to be in control. They just want it to, have a more, liberal approach to, liberal in the Democratic Party sense, what the FCC's rules are going to be. You also had some opposition coming from people on the far right who were afraid, actually, that the change in the ownership regulations would make it easier for, quote-unquote, indecent material to get on the air. And I actually heard when people were bringing up horror stories of what might happen, I kept looking for people to say, well, here's a station that wants to put something on the air locally, but the big media company isn't letting them. And instead, what you kept hearing was, here was a station that didn't want to put something on the air, but the networks wanted them to because it violated local community standards. But since the FCC made its decision, and since it sort of crystallized as the attention of people who are simply upset about, this media concentration and want to have much more open access to the airwaves, that's unleashed a lot of activism around much more important things, like, as I said earlier, expanding the options for getting low-power radio stations on the air or getting more of them on the air.
Well, but that's not going to happen during Bush years.
No,
couldn't even get it done when Clinton tried to do it at the very end of his term. The Congress killed it, right?
Well, the Congress effectively killed it. What happened was that William Kennard, who was the SDC chief at the time.
And who was a member of the Carlisle Group's board of directors, too.
Yeah, now that's his post-SDC job, proposed what was a very limited plan for getting low-power FM stations on the air. It didn't go nearly as far as they could have gone. And even so, it got both the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio so upset that they lobbied Congress to eviscerate it even more, to the point where, you know, basically you're getting these stations in very rural areas, but not in cities at all. And not nearly as many as you could get, you know, in a lot of rural areas.
Well, and even then, it was mostly church stations and the kind of things that are already on the air anyway.
Well, that's true and it's not true. I mean, there are some more interesting stations going on the air, and a lot of times where you see a church station going on the air, it's because nobody else in that community bothered to apply for it. And I think some people kind of dropped the ball, when it came time to take advantage of, what program was released at all. Sorry, I got something in my throat. But what I was saying about whether this would happen in Bush years, I don't see, you know, Michael Powell obviously supporting anything like Kennard did. Powell voted against the plan. Powell is supposed to be a big free market guy who doesn't believe in the government playing favorites, but when it came time for him to explain his vote against Low Power FM, he explicitly said, we've got to, this could take away audiences from, even though these were all going to be non-commercial stations, audiences away from commercial stations, undermine their ability to sell time to air advertisers, and we've got to protect their profit stream.
Really? He came right out and said that, huh?
He did not use the words protect their profit stream, but I mean, that's what he was talking about. And if you go to the FCC's website and look up the commissioner's statements, on the vote, the final vote, he abstained when the initial proposal was put up, and then when the final version after the public comment was put up for vote, he voted against it. So on the one hand, I don't see Michael Powell coming behind us, but on the other hand, you know, there's the possibility that activists can take advantage of the anger in Congress, which is moving to overturn what the FCC did in June, and tack on, an effort to overturn what was done a couple years earlier with the low power program, because it wasn't the FCC again that killed low power FM or wounded it severely. It was Congress, and so Congress is what you want to look to. And when this anger in Congress happening at the same time as the revelation that of this. Report that the FCC commissioned, which basically showed that all the so-called concerns about interference that low power FM was going to cause were misguided, were misplaced, in many cases were lies, although it doesn't say that. That presents an opportunity. Whether anything will come of the opportunity, who knows? I mean, I do tend to be pretty cynical about this stuff, too. But, the fact is that there's a much more chance of it happening right now than there was this time last year, and frankly, than there will be this time next year, unless there's another event that opens the door a bit like this.
Well, there's an article that you wrote, I guess, around the time that they came out with the licenses that I read on the internet, where you talked about, we'll see in a year from now how many pirate radio stations there are on the air, and that will be the measure of whether the FCC went far enough. So that really got me curious as to whether you know how many pirate stations there are in America.
I don't
approximately.
Know how many. I don't know. I mean, when I was during the big pirate radio boom of the 1990s, there were a lot of estimates. You heard about how many pirate stations there were, and I think I might have even quoted one in one of my earlier articles on the subject before I started just seeing. The extent to which people were pulling this out of their posteriors. There was the only solid numbers you had were the FCC, the number of stations the FCC was shutting down, and that was very informative. You could see, my goodness, there's like a really big cluster down here in southern Florida, but that was partly because they had a really hard-ass enforcement chief down in southern Florida. So at any rate, no, I couldn't tell you. And the other reason why it's harder to tell right now is because when the movement for legal low-power FM stations really picked up steam, that is the movement of people, separate from the movement of people who are just trying to get stations on the air and in some cases challenging the FCC in court, there emerged when one effect of the boom in unlicensed stations in the 90s was that it created a crisis of authority for the Federal Communications Commission. And one way they responded to it was by saying, well, we're going to give people a limited option for getting on the air without defying our authority, without opening the door as far as we could, and with the requirements in place that were allegedly, although you could debate how well it worked out from their point of view in practice, keep people who had been pirates in the past and who wouldn't go off the air right then when they proposed this from getting low-power FM licenses in the future. And so there's a lot of activists who have been really in the first movement, moved into this other movement of lobbying Congress and helping people get on the air legally after the low-power plan was passed. And a lot of them were the best activists in the pirate radio world. And one result is that while you have some really lively local and regional pirate radio scenes right now, you don't have the national consciousness that was beginning to emerge in the mid to late 90s. I mean, it was even sort of tenuous then. I can remember, like around 97, 98, there was this sort of East Coast pirate scene and this West Coast pirate scene, and these were generally people who could not afford to fly out. Like, if they had a conference on one coast, there'd be a couple people who managed to fly out from the other side. But it was very, even then, very regionally based, and the only one that I went to that had a lot of people from both East and West was, you know, out there in Texas, which had it was in between, so it was easier for people to meet in the middle. And now even that kind of East and West kind of unity, you know, has dissolved a bit. And I keep hearing about stations that are out there and interesting projects, but it's you don't have as much of it's much harder to get a global view of what's happening. Also, another thing that's happened is that internet stations have become so much more both easier, you know, to get on the air and more plausible as a way to reach an audience. Now that more and more people are getting online, and now that, you know, some people have moved away from content streams to just putting up reports so that people can download, or you know internet music streams and so on. So that in some ways you're not talking about exactly a unitary station, but sometimes these are linked up with pirate stations or part-time pirate stations that are all the time on the internet, but only sometimes on the air. And it gets hard to figure out exactly how you're even going to count some of these, whether they're half a station or two stations or what.
Well, I think that's a very important lesson there about how the movement was going so strong until Congress came, or until the executive branch came and said, oh, you know what, let's help you guys out, deregulate you guys a little bit, give you an opportunity to get a license. And they yanked our teeth out, and like you said, all the best leaders of the pirate radio movement around America basically all retired because they gave a crumb and then took it back. I mean, they ended up not even following through with...
Well, they didn't retire. I mean, but I know that some of the people who were some of the most effective workers in getting unlicensed radio stations on the air, like a lot of people who were involved in the Prometheus Radio Project, are now some of the most effective people in helping people take advantage of what's left of the low-power FM program. And have helped some really good stations get on the air, but, you know, it's, you know, the pirate movement's loss. And also a lot of the people who are left, a lot of the people who weren't attracted by, going legal are the same people who aren't necessarily attracted by going national. So they're doing things like they're still helping, you know, migrant farm workers start stations in all Spanish, in California here and there, and it's great what they're doing, but it's simply not the same. It isn't filling that particular void that was, you know, left back around 1998 when this shift happened in the movement's focus. And I wouldn't tell those people stop doing what you're doing because they're doing a really good job. But I do wish that I wish that there could be some sort of return. Some people would fill that gap of getting all these stations talking to each other, you know, trading tips and strategizing about how they're going to deal with the government and the other problems they face.
You know, when you're talking about the earlier when we were talking about the deregulation still,
mm-hmm.
and you're saying that a lot of the people who are came out opposed to it, that they were pretty disingenuous and they only kind of wanted the regulation to be their way and
yeah.
not really get rid of the FCC and that, or, well, I think your words were they still want the FCC to be the ones in charge. And so I wonder, if not the FCC, what's a good alternative for dividing up band space in this country?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I should say, first of all, that you can be for opening up the airwaves substantially and not be for a radical kill the FCC program. I mean, there's all sorts of intermediate steps which we could talk about that would make things easier. But as far as, you know, radical alternatives to the FCC, there's two basic models, and they're not incompatible, although people sometimes talk like they are. And one of them you can call the radical free market model. And the other one, to be a little obnoxious, I'll call the radical communist model, although actually some of the people who supported are very conservative, like George Galder, for example. And the first model is basically to treat the spectrum as property. And we've moved to some extent towards this in the last few decades. But the full-fledged version would be if spectrum is not being used, you're able to homestead it. Interference, which, you know, and then own it. Interference is treated as a tort, like it's trespass. And instead of having a centralized authority doling out licenses, you just have, you know, some basic rules of the road that everybody has to follow. But, you know, again, this was one of the a system that was starting to emerge in the 1920s when the Federal Radio Commission, which later became the Federal Communications Commission, was imposed instead. And if you want, we can double back and talk about that. The other later, the other approach, what I would call the you know, the communist approach, isn't actually communist in the sense of being incompatible with private property. What it is people have talked about using the spectrum as a commons. Not in the sense of everybody owning it in common, but in the sense that you wouldn't own discrete chunks of spectrum. You would, but because of things like ultra-wideband, Wi-Fi, all sort of the children's of so-called spread spectrum technology that allow people to use different parts of the spectrum essentially simultaneously, you know, it would be, there's no need to divide it up, they say. You can simply use devices that, you know, smart radios that, I guess the easiest way to visualize it is the signals know how to avoid each other, and the intelligence is at the end of the system and the receiver, which can pick out what the important signals are and then reassemble them for you to listen to, or you know, whatever you're going to do with it, because we're not just talking about radio broadcasts here. I mean, it's context people are talking about this in, obviously, is as an alternative to wired broadband, so having wireless broadband instead. And in fact, while there's, it's these are not all that incompatible, because if you do divide up the spectrum and say this is private property, I think that any, you know, libertarian approach to that has to say that if you can, is that what you're trying to prohibit is interfering with someone else's signal. So it's not like someone, when I own my plot of land, that doesn't mean I own it all the way up to the end of the atmosphere and no one can fly over it. If an airplane goes by several miles overhead and it doesn't, you know, there isn't like smoke billowing down on where I can breathe it, that's not considered a trespass on my property. Well, similarly, if I own, you know, a chunk of spectrum that I'm broadcasting over the radio station, or a company or a nonprofit collective or a church or a school or what have you owns this, and someone else has a signal that can use that same portion of the spectrum, but knows to how to fill the spaces. I'm trying to not get technical with this, but avoid interfering with it. Well, then there's absolutely no reason why that should be prohibited. So you can see the two models coexisting as long as the rules of the road allow it. And if the so-called commons model really is more effective, then you can, then it would gradually, take over because people would just be able to do that and you'd be able to fill more of the spectrum that way. So those are the two larger models. As far as intermediate ways just to open up the spectrum and allow more people on it, one is what we've just been talking about, allowing lower power stations on the air. Another is to allow people to broadcast between one another on the air. I mean, you need buffer zones between stations, but what we have now is based on the technology of the 1950s. It's very possible to squeeze more stations onto the radio dial that we listen to now. Another thing that can be done is just to reallocate some of the space. It's it's a channel 6 is often what's allocated, I should say, to channel 6 for TV. Is in many markets, for example, not being used by television. That also happens to be immediately adjacent to the FM band, and many FM receivers could pick up something that was being broadcast in that space, and you could make room for several more stations in the space that's being used for one TV station. You could also have broadcasts for much further away in the electromagnetic spectrum, not immediately adjacent to what's allocated to AM or FM, but have a market in so-called down converters, which would essentially you would put them next to or attached to a radio, and it would be able to convert it from this portion of the spectrum into something that your old-fashioned radio would be able to pick up. The equivalent that a lot of people would be familiar with would be, you get DirecTV and something that's broadcast, and the satellite portion of the band can now be picked up by a TV that's only originally built to pick up UHF and VHF signals. There's also just more flexibility in how people can use their stations right now. If somebody owns a station which broadcasts over, we'll say for the sake of simplicity, 100 square miles. Right now, if they can't make a go at it and they want to sell it, their only real option is to sell that whole chunk of ethereal territory. You can't break it up and say, I'm going to sell off the right, I'm going to decrease my power and sell off the right to broadcast over this portion of it to some smaller community group or a small business or something like that. Because you have only a license to broadcast over this particular space, and you can only sell that whole license. And as a result, people, when they can't make a go of it, they sell out to chains. That's a complete contrast with the way things work, for example, in cities, where initially you can see a big building is constructed for use of one single enterprise. Often it's what paid to build that building, but then gradually, over time, small shops and small enterprises are able to come into the block and lease space or buy space and gradually moves into a more diverse environment. And there's a long passage in one of Jane Jacobs' books when she talks about the way cities evolve like this and the way healthy cities have this room for community and entrepreneurial diversity. And I had one of those eureka moments reading it and seeing that this is the exact opposite of the way that the spectrum is treated. So and there's other ways as well. So there's lots and lots of intermediate steps. I should say one other areas of hope to look at is that while there's the artificial scarcity on the FM band has led the cost of licenses to be bid up higher and higher. The price of licenses in the AM band in a lot of markets has been falling. And as a result, there have been cases of, in one very rural area, I think it was in Arizona, a license was auctioned off by the FCC for essentially the cost of a used car. In Las Vegas, which is a much bigger city, obviously, around the same time, one was licensed, auctioned off, and it sold for the cost of several used cars. I mean, not something that one individual could necessarily pick up. I'm blanking on what it was. I'm thinking it was around $60,000. Maybe I'm off on that. But it was much cheaper than you would expect one of these stations to go for, and
well,
definitely
and even
much
then,
cheaper than ones on the FL.
Even then, $60,000 is pretty cost prohibitive. I mean, you got to already be a company to.
Well, there's a difference between, again, what's happening in cities and the countryside. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't afford to buy that station in Las Vegas, but that, you know, number one, that shows a change in direction in the market. And number two, that shows that, you know, it's easier for at least at the very smaller businesses to get into the game and have if they want to really do something different from what's being done elsewhere on the dial. And then when you look at what's happening, you know, in the countryside, when something was sold, it was like $6,000-$8,000, something like that. I mean, a lot of the groups that are pulling together their resources to get low power FM stations on the air could have afforded to pull together the resources to get to buy that license as well. So again, I'm not being utopian about the AM band. I'm saying that's another place where some space may be opening up, simply because so many people have abandoned the AM band. I mean, as for music, FM is better for transmitting music because, you know, there's so much more static on AM. But AM has shown, you know, that with talk radio, it doesn't matter as much if there's, you know, some of that static, and that's where the talk radio boom has happened. And if some people want to do some alternatives to, you know, your standard forms of talk radio, in many parts of the country, though, again, not as much in, like, your heavily urban areas, that could be an area that's opening up. Until the foot comes down again, right?
Yeah, I guess so. It's all a matter of time, back and forth,
yeah,
constant,
you know,
struggle. But
I don't know. I don't know. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead, man.
I was just going to say I don't often get a chance to be optimistic. I don't know that you do either. So I've been trying to work this into the interviews because it's. I think really there's more promise for people being able to take advantage of space unexpectedly opening up on the AM band than there is for people getting like a serious low power FM proposal or expansion of the current low power FM path, despite what I was saying earlier about, you know, the opportunity that's been opened up by the anger over what the FCC did in June.
Well, and that's a really good point too, because, you know, low power is still low power. If you buy an AM license, you can go out at 50,000 watts or something, right?
Yeah, well, it depends, but on the license. But the other thing about AM is that how far you go with wattage is different. I mean, like the signal skip. You pick up AM stations across the country. You can, you know, point the transmitter in one particular direction, and it just shoots off very, really far in that direction, and almost nowhere can hear it. No one can hear you behind it, which is different from your, you know, FM, which tend to be like these little puddles or sometimes big puddles. Again, I'm using maybe inadequate metaphors, but even if they do manage to get the old William Kennard's original FM proposal reenacted, which I think is much more than you can reasonably expect to see tacked on to, a congressional bill to undo what the FCC did in June. That was still an incredibly limited proposal, and people are going to be scrambling to grab just a small handful of licenses in these urban areas that are going to be, you know, opened up a bit. Whereas, you know, some people can maybe be a little crafty and see, well, what's coming up on the AM band? Is there anything in my particular community? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But, I mean, that what I mentioned, the the one that went off for the cost of a used car, or the somewhat more expensive one in Las Vegas. One reason why those were so cheap was because only in both cases only one entity bothered to bid for those licenses. And again, that's the reason why a lot of the LPFM stations, the low-power FM stations, have ended up in the hands of churches. They're the ones that bothered to bid for them. And, you know, media activists or people with, like, media ideas, you know, for doing something different than, you know, all the Clear Channels and Cumulus stations, you got to keep your eyes open for these things. And if you strike at the right place in the right time, you might end up being able to do something more than just, say, a website, which is what a lot of people just end up with, and I'm all for using the web, but, you know, a lot of people got, you can carry around a radio in a way that it's still difficult to carry around a computer, despite Wi-Fi and all that.
Yeah, most people listen to the radio while they're in their car, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's not like people have got their laptops up in their car. Most people don't, and then, like, tuning into their favorite online radio station while they drive. That might happen 5 years from now, or however many years from now, but for right now, you know, radio is a much more effective medium.
You know, when you mentioned Cox and all those other giant companies, Clear Channel and those guys,
yeah.
It makes me wonder, actually, how many, or maybe I should say, how few companies really own the mass media in the United States?
That is a good question, which I don't know the top of my head, but I actually know a website that's got it, and I'm sitting right in front of my computer. I'm going to pretend to be an expert and actually leech off of them if I can find this.
I know there's been a lot of mergers lately.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing is, there's still much more diversity of ownership in radio than there is in, say, television, probably because TV is so much more capital-intensive. And also, like, you don't have those same sort of network dominance in radio that you have in television. And so while there's been this rapid increase in the rate at which, you know, stations are being snatched up, slowed somewhat by the change in the FCC made in June, because while they loosened the regulations for TV, they actually strengthened the regulations for radio, in part because of the big backlash against Clear Channel that's going on. There's still considerable diversity of ownership. Oh, I see why it didn't come up. Why it didn't come up there? Here we go. The Who Owns What page. There's a website at cjr.org/owners. Again, that's cjr.org/owners. And this is the Columbia Journalism Review's site that is basically a guide to who owns what. I'm not going to go down here and dig up statistics to try to put some together, but what they do is they list the two or three dozen largest media companies, and not just talking about radio here, but we're talking about newspaper chains and so on, and you can click on each name and see exactly what each what the holdings of each one is. Like, I just clicked on the Hearst Corporation, and here we've got about a dozen newspapers, about a dozen magazines, a whole slew of TV stations, then a whole bunch of their business media, a bunch of cable channels. I didn't know Hearst owned Lifetime and A&E. Two radio stations, both of them here in Baltimore where I am, and then interactive media, including investments in XM satellite radio, Netscape, and you can sort of see, playing around the site, not just the extent of concentration, but the extent to which what you might initially mistake for an independent company is in fact owned or co-owned by conglomerates.
Right, and then they all have interlocking boards of directors between a few different conglomerates, too.
Yeah, so again, that's cjr.org/owners, and it's a very useful resource.
Nice. Hey, I want to change the subject a little bit. I read speaking of online and media, I was reading Reason.com, looking through some of your past articles, and I found a column that you wrote called Roll Over James Madison, and it was about... Not so much focused on the repeal of liberty in the United States since September 11th, but on the further repeal of federalism. And I wonder if you could just kind of I mean, I don't know. I'll just let you go from there and kind of maybe you can tell people, explain to them what that article was about, what kind of point you were trying to get at there.
Yeah, well, it was, a lot was being written about the loss of liberties in the war of terrorism to the point where, you know, whatever else you could say about it, you couldn't say that people weren't hearing about it. And at the same time, the injuries being done to federalism, which is, you know, the very principle let me back up a second. I mean, there's usually when people talk about federalism, they just mean about the relationship between the states and the national government and having greater autonomy and authority for the lower the states. But in fact, I was using federalism in this larger sense of also meaning, you know, even the lower levels of government, you know, the cities, the townships, and the counties, because I think that along with supporting individual liberty, it's good to want to have, you know, what government you do have decentralized to the lowest level as possible, partly because it's easier to vote with your feet by moving from one unit of government to another when you don't like the way the decisions one is making or the way things are being run, and also because you have more of a voice in a smaller body of citizens. And there are a lot of damage is being done to this principle as well. I mean, a lot of power is being concentrated in Washington that weren't necessarily concentrated there before. And the reason why you weren't hearing about it is because conservatives weren't talking about it. You usually rely on, you know, libertarians and the ACLU wing of liberals to talk about individual liberty. And, you know, one thing that conservatives have traditionally been good at talking about is federalism. And some of them were doing a job of it. I cited Phyllis Schlafly, actually, as an example, someone who had talked about the increased federal controls that were being imposed. She mentioned Operation TIPS, which was the allegedly dumped proposal for a clearinghouse for people snitching on each other.
Oh, yeah, they just renamed that and call it Talon now.
But that was what the talk was at the time, was Operation TIPS. That's what she was citing in her column. There's the USA Patriot Act, the what became eventually the Department of Homeland Security, but at the same time, people like say Jonah Goldberg of National Review, or David Horowitz of Front Page Magazine, and James Toronto of the Wall Street Journal, who in other contexts were very, very, you know, pro-federalist in their rhetoric, suddenly became silent when 9/11 and the war on terror, and then the other ancillary wars that don't have so much to do with terror, erupted. So that you have we've had a Republican administration federalizing airport security. They've imposed new unfunded mandates on local transportation authorities. I mentioned peace. They were flirting with moving the military into domestic police work. The Department of Homeland Security, you know, since I wrote the piece, has concentrated a lot into its offices that were previously not done. There was a lot of discussion of things being done under the Department of Homeland Security that were previously done by other agencies, but they were also absorbing functions that had previously been done on a lower level. So there is all this was going on, and not only was it being missed by supposed, you know, small government conservatives, but some of the people who previously had preached their federalism, like Jonah Goldberg, were specifically denouncing, like, these small government federalist conservatives alongside the libertarians they were denouncing for not getting with the program on 9/11.
Well, you have dishonest opinion makers like Jonah Goldberg, but then you also have just the average conservative in America who's just rooting for the winning team, and as long as a Republican is behind big government, then it must be okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this habit in the United States to confuse conservatism with republicanism, and for that matter, to confuse liberalism with the fortunes of the Democratic Party. And it's, I think a lot of people, you know, including some of the National Review people, are now waking up to the fact that even from just a down-the-line, mainline conservative point of view, the Bush administration is not enacting that agenda. They're enacting parts of it, But there, I mean, just look at the amount of money that George W. Bush has been spending so far. I mean, like I think he's racing to outdo Lyndon Johnson. I mean, this is not, in any meaningful sense of the word, a conservative administration. It's a Republican administration that leans right on a bunch of issues, but has no compunction against the sorts of but regularly evades the kinds of limits that honest conservatives have always thought were necessary to the checks and balances of a constitutional republic.
So it's really only the conservatives who just like to go along and root for the winning team of whoever's calling themselves conservatives. The people
who have read
the tenets of conservatism, they're not buying it. I mean, Charlie Reese ain't buying it. You read his
Although Charlie Reese isn't always sure if he's going to call himself a conservative anymore because of the people who do call themselves conservatives. It's not just a matter of people who want to root for the winning team. I think that there's this, you know, a part of it has to do with trust. A lot of conservatives who are kind of radicalized during the Clinton years because they didn't trust the person in Washington, and they didn't want Washington to have powers because they thought, well, look, someone like Bill Clinton or Janet Reno could use this against me. And then they get someone like George W. Bush or John Ashcroft that more superficially resembles them in office, and all that skepticism and disappears. And the problem is, you know, they don't seem to recognize that even if Bush and Ashcroft had their best interests at heart, that doesn't mean the next president and attorney general isn't going to turn around and treat you the way they treated, you know, David Koresh or Elian Gonzalez. And, you know, the flip side of that, of course, is I'm hearing all this skepticism from liberals and Democrats who, hate Bush and Ashcroft, but because they saw that sort of superficial resemblance between them and Clinton and Reno, never raised a peep when Clinton was ramming through his Anti-Terrorism Act in the wake of Oklahoma City, which had much more to do with suppressing civil liberties than with ending terrorism, as we learned subsequently with ongoing terrorism. And when you had the same sort of rhetoric that people like Ann Coulter unleash on liberals and pacifists now, saying that they're all traitors, you know, she's just using the same playbook that Bill Clinton and his defenders were using against conservative talk radio show hosts and property rights activists and others in the wake of Oklahoma City, when they were suggesting that anyone who had been harshly critical of government somehow bore some resemblance for the murder of all those people at that building.
And meanwhile, these politicians are just fine as long as they, like Bill Clinton's mentor Carol Quigley said, as long as they trade off every 8 or even 4 years if necessary, they'll have half the people with them and the other half against them, but that'll be okay because in another 4 years they'll just switch off, and half the people who were mad will be content, and the people who are content will be mad again, but they all get a break every 4 or 8 years, and nobody ever stays mad except the, I guess, 2% of us or so who are actual independents or libertarians in this country.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's 2%. I mean, I'm happy to see that, you know, a lot of towns have been declaring themselves, you know, Bill of Rights zones and passing resolutions against the Patriot Act and saying, in effect, that if their police are asked to do anything unconstitutional, they're not authorizing to do it. It's essentially a symbolic gesture. In some cases, it's legally incoherent, but it's very good to watch. And for initially, it was just coming from, towns on the left end of the spectrum. But, you know, just recently, there were three towns that tend to lean right in rural Washington State, or which sort of, in one case, kind of one person was telling me more wobbles between left and right because there's like a hippie contingent, but, you know, there's right-wing hippies too. That are making these statements. I think that it's not impossible for people on the right to wake up to what Bush and his administration are doing. What's kind of depressing to me is that on the one hand, there was in the 90s, you know, a lot of people were talking about going beyond left and right and beyond that whole kind of shell game where you only fear what's happening from one end of the spectrum. And a lot of those people have then gotten absorbed by the whole kind of Republican clone mentality we were talking about earlier, And meanwhile, a lot of the people who are getting skeptical now are not drawing the lessons backwards. And in fact, they see, you know, Clinton as a victim. They see the worst figure of the 90s as Richard Mellon Scaife. And that's, you know, I mean, I'm the first to say that a lot of the Clinton critics got kind of excessive with, you know, the theories are being tossed around. But I think that this, it's as though people are, that are now getting suspicious, unlike in the 90s when there were, people were saying, be independent, so go beyond left and right, you know, don't trust Newt Gingrich, don't trust Bob Dole. Now a lot of people who are skeptical have a really hardcore Democratic Party. Like, if we just got someone like Howard Dean, who's a real Democrat, as our nominee, you know, we could take this country back from the Bush gang.
We're and, doomed. Yeah,
Damn. Damn. Now I'm being pessimistic again.
All you in the audience, listen up. You're all going to die.
Well, we're all going to die sometime, right?
Yeah, well, we're all going to die at the hands of the state as long as people keep believing in false alternatives like Howard Dean, for crying out loud. He's like, oh, I'm a total statist and a total interventionist and a total internationalist, and I'm 1,000,000% loyal to Israel, but I just disagree about this one particular lie for this one particular war, and all the Democrats climb on board.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah, it's, although I'm not convinced that, I get the impression that a lot of the people who are joining the Howard Dean movement are doing so to meet dates, and I think that's a healthy effort to put the personal ahead of the political and to move away from politics towards individualist concerns. So that's the biggest positive spin that I can put on the Howard Dean movement.
Hey, that was very nice, man. Your mom taught you good manners.
Right.
Very nice.
So I guess our hour's wrapping up here. Was there anything else you wanted to get into before the end of the...
I can't think of too much more except to tell everybody that they've been listening for an hour or so here to Jesse Walker, the associate editor of Reason Magazine, the author of Rebels on the Air, an alternative history of radio in America. You can look up, it's reason.com, right?
Yes, and my site is jessewalker.blogspot.com, and that includes links to places that I write for besides Reason as well, so... When stories pop up in an alternative weekly here or a magazine there, I'll link to it there as well.
Excellent. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on the air today.
Well, thanks for having me here.